This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. As we've seen from recent emergencies and disasters, including tornadoes, floods, an influenza pandemic, earthquakes, damage to a nuclear facility, and a large oil spill, there is always an impact to the public health and medical care. Strengthening the country's public health preparedness and response takes many forms and complementary efforts. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, plays a critical role in seeing this through, pursuing a strategy for national health security that promotes resilient communities and health systems that coordinate, work together, before, during, and after disasters. What is national health security, and how do we get there as a country? How are we strengthening public health and medical preparedness, response, and recovery capabilities? And what is being done to ensure the availability of safe and effective medical countermeasures in the event of a public health emergency? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dr. Nicole Lorie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Lorie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's great to have you. I'd like to start off first to get a sense of the history and mission of the office you lead, the Office of Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. Well, you know, there's always been an emergency response component to Health and Human Services. But my office, the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, is relatively new and was formed out of a lesson learned from Hurricane Katrina. That, in fact, it was the, I think, very wise opinion of many that all of the emergency response functions needed to be consolidated in one place. And in some place, there was, in some ways, there was a place the buck needed to stop here, that somebody needed to take responsibility from beginning to end for all that happened or might happen. And so the office was created at that time. It had a predecessor organization or two, one obviously dealing with the National Disaster Medical System that's been around for a very long time, and the other dealing with the need to develop medical countermeasures after 9/11 and the anthrax attacks. The mission, in fact, everything coming together under one roof, is relatively broad. On the one hand, my responsibilities are to coordinate policies on behalf of the secretary across the department, because lots of different parts of Health and Human Services, NIH, FDA, CDC, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration, on and on, all have a piece in emergency response. So first and foremost is a policy advising and coordination role that we do for the secretary. Secondly, we are responsible for the secretary's operations center and for the medical response components of an emergency. So under that, the National Disaster Medical System and other components exist. And if a community or state is overwhelmed and asks for federal assistance in one way or another, then the National Disaster Medical System kicks in and helps out. And then thirdly, we are responsible for what's called the advanced development and procurement of medical countermeasures for the strategic national stockpile. And those can be anything from flu vaccine for a pandemic, or for that matter, an H1N1, or countermeasures or vaccines against more traditional biothreats like smallpox or anthrax or botulism. So it's really a tripartite mission in a sense, and it makes it an exciting place to work because it's a place where science and medicine and public health and policy all come together. And I'd like to say in the health sort of lane, you know, typically medicine and public health are on parallel tracks, never to meet. But this is a place where they really come together and meet and work collaboratively.
With such an interesting mission, I'd like to get a sense of the scale of operation in which you lead. How is your office organized, the size of its budget, number of folks who help you out and work for you, and the geographical footprint?
So we have about 700 direct employees, give or take. And then the National Disaster Medical System, which is intermittent employees, is a little over 7,000 who get called up in a disaster. Our 700 people are largely but not entirely based in the D.C. area. We have a pretty significant regional footprint. So in each of the 10 regions, we have staff. We have emergency coordinators and responders of one kind or another. Our budget is about $925 million, which includes our emergency response components and the advanced development of countermeasures. And then there has been an additional budget to procure medical countermeasures for the stockpile. That's the buying insurance for the country piece of it that we do.
Oh, interesting. So I'd like to focus on your specific responsibilities as Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response. Mm-hmm. What are your duties and what are the areas under your purview? And more interestingly, how do you support the overall effort of HHS?
My primary role is to advise the Secretary and leading this, as you can tell, very diverse operation of people who are scientists, people who are responders, people who are policy wonks. They all sort of come together, right? On the one hand, we work with the rest of federal government in the interagency. And, you know, had you ever asked me, could the federal government really pull together and focus and all be on the same page before I came into this job, I would have had a lot of skepticism. Mm-hmm. But in fact, it does. And it's done that routinely in the disasters I've been involved with, whether it's H1N1 or Haiti or Hurricane Sandy or others. So, you know, there's the part of working with all of the rest of the federal agencies and also being a voice for health at the table, because, in fact, health is part of any disaster, whether you recognize it initially or not. Then there's the piece of it that involves helping our nation be prepared. And so that means working with state and local government, with the private sector, and with citizens around the country to create a culture and a practice of preparedness. And so we work on both of these ways. And then because, in my mind, preparedness and response rest on the back of strong day-to-day systems. We can't have a good preparedness and response system of our country unless we've got an emergency care system that works well, a health care system that works well. We can't have resilient people unless we have healthy people. And so our work interfaces with the work of the rest of the department at every step of the way. And then certainly in a disaster, the whole department comes together and contributes, and we're sort of the belly button and the coordinator for all that.
So with such an impressive array of duties and responsibilities and expansive, what are some of the top challenges, maybe the top three management challenges you face, and how have you sought to address them?
Well, let's see, there are three maybe overarching challenges, and then maybe some additional management issues, which are worth talking about for a minute. You know, first, overall, the mission, building a resilient nation and a culture of preparedness, is a challenge because most people in our country don't feel threatened day to day, fortunately. So building that culture of resilience and the culture of preparedness, number one challenge. Dealing with a public health infrastructure that is somewhat in disrepair and that is continuing to lose jobs around the country is counter to what we try to do in building a nation that's prepared. And so dealing with the political and budget realities on the ground, second big challenge. And thirdly, I think sustaining a national commitment to preparedness. People's memories are short. When something happens, they want to know, why haven't you done something about it? And what have you done to be ready? And why aren't you at the ready all the time? But as you get distant from any disaster, people's memories wane, the funding goes down, and their support to maintain it is less. And so then we constantly have to pay catch up. And that's not a very efficient way to run anything. And so keeping the nation focused and that commitment to preparedness is really important. I would say on the management side, because our mission is broad as it is, we've got very different cultures within the organization. We have a culture of scientists is very different than a culture of responders and is very different from a culture of policymakers. And their worldviews are different. Their approach to thinking and problem solving is different. It's what makes it a lot of fun, but it also makes it challenging.
So given your background and your career path, what makes an effective leader? What are some of the characteristics of an effective leader?
I think that there are several. I think, you know, first of all, having a clear vision and mission and providing clear direction is pretty important. In order to develop that, you need to listen to lots of people on lots of different perspectives. I think not being afraid to challenge or question dogma or the way things are also pretty important to being an effective leader. Being able to bring people together, recognizing that good ideas come from anywhere and everywhere, and being able to seek out those good ideas and then use them in an action plan, I think, is pretty important. Being able to resolve conflict and being able to make decisions, often rapidly, hopefully having heard all sides and grounding it in the best available science and information.
So your role is fraught with a lot of unanticipated, unexpected surprises. What were some of the surprises since you've taken over?
The thing that surprises me most is how many earthquakes there are in the world and how often. But it's almost a metaphor for the fact that the unexpected happens all the time. Yes, there are lots of earthquakes in the world, but things happen with, I think, an unexpected frequency. And you always know something's going to happen. You don't know what it's going to be. But that in some sense, dealing with most of them turns out to require pretty much the same skill set and the same set of capabilities. You know, you always need surveillance. You always need to investigate what's going on. You always need to be a superb communicator. You always need to deal with fears. You always need science. A pleasant surprise for me has been the way all of HHS and, in fact, all of government and the American people really pull together when the chips are down. The trick is to bottle that and figure out how to help people come together with that same focus, determination, and energy outside of the context of an emergency.
What is national health security, and how do we get there as a country? We will ask Dr. Nicole Lorre, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? What is being done to ensure the safety and soundness of the country's credit union system? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more wisely? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative new technologies and open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Nicole Lorre, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So, Dr. Lorre, your office is charged with leading the nation in public health and emergency preparedness, response, and recovery. Before we delve into your priorities, what is national health security, and how do we get there as a country?
Well, what I would say is that disasters take many forms, and they affect all of us. We like to think that national health security is achieved when our country and all of our communities together are prepared to respond and recover from the health impacts of emergencies. To do this, you need strong, modern, nimble health and emergency response systems. You also need to have resilient people. And so that means, ideally, that you have people who are healthy. Prevention becomes very important. You can't have people who are worried about their health every day or health insecure. So on the one hand, we focus and very much support the prevention and health promotion missions of our department to help our country be better and stronger. And on the other hand, we really want to focus on building resilience so that people can recover from health emergencies faster.
So I'd like to explore your strategic vision and what frames your direction of your office. Would you highlight your key strategic priorities? And what are some of the key cross-cutting themes that inform your strategic approach?
The key themes and our overarching goals are, number one, having communities and individuals that are really able to withstand adversity. Having modernized systems with the capabilities that are not just on the shelf, but exercised and continually improving. So whether it is the healthcare system being able to move people to what I would call the next lowest level of safe and appropriate care, or a system that can rapidly vaccinate a population or get pills in mouth quickly, a modernized system with those capabilities that we exercise and know we can do if we have to. Making sure that we have the right policies at the national level to allow resilience to grow and develop and spread across the country, and that those policies are jointly developed by those they affect, really all of us. And then building our organization. As I said, our organization is relatively new. It doesn't have the long and impressive history that so many do. And so really building this organization, not quite, but almost from the ground up in terms of developing a staff and a team and leadership team, developing our people for the next generation of leadership, creating a culture and processes and procedures for doing things.
You've mentioned a couple of times the promotion of a resilient community or a resilient population. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the vigilance of resilience in a sense. How do you folks do that? What are some of the initiatives you have in place to do that?
Well, we've done that in a lot of really interesting ways. I should preface this by saying that most people judge how bad a disaster is by how quickly they can bounce back, right? And so this concept of resilience and being able to bounce back quickly turns out to be really, really important. But we've taken on some very specific initiatives to deal with resilience and to be sure that it's a driver of the health security programs across government. One that you'll probably be most interested in is one that we've been doing with social media. So we know that people who are connected with one another, who have strong social support, who are friends and relatives, they can count on an emergency, live longer, are healthier, and are more resilient. So one question we had was, well, how could we go about doing this? Well, what is it that most people use day to day? They use social media. And so we said, wouldn't it be a great idea if we could get a Facebook app, for example, where people could identify their lifelines? Turns out Facebook doesn't write apps, doesn't develop apps. The other people do on a Facebook platform. And so we were actually the first part of the department to use the America Competes Act, the ability to have challenges and competitions. And we put out a national competition for people to develop a lifeline app. And we got all kinds of really interesting submissions and ultimately awarded two contestants for this with lifeline apps. And they're working on launching those. And the goal, quite honestly, wasn't that those be the end-all and the be-all of Facebook apps, but that we start to try to stimulate the market in a variety of different ways so that at the end of the day, however it is that it happens, people get lifelines, mm-hmm. and that that idea catches on and that you have friends or family or people you can really count on when the chips are down. So that's one way. A second way that we've been doing this in a very a much narrower but very much fragile population are people who are dependent on various medical technologies to stay alive. And usually those medical technologies involve electricity or oxygen or something. And so we've started now a health resilience technology program to look at what are the kinds of technologies that would help people be able to stay at home when the power's out and the chips are down in that way, or help them get ancillary power. So we're in the process now of working through the development of signaling devices so that their medical equipment will signal either friends or an operations center or both when they don't have much battery life left and somebody can come get them a charge or get them batteries and that they can stay at home. So that's another way. One is through social media. One is through technologies. We work a lot on making the healthcare system resilient. So we just saw, for example, in Hurricane Sandy, what happened when nursing homes and hospitals lost power and had to evacuate. Well, what you really want is a system in a community that if one part of it is sick or injured, then another piece of it can pick up the slack. And so we've been supporting the development of what we call healthcare coalitions. So coalitions of all of the different kinds of healthcare entities to work together to support the community through an emergency. So that's another kind of resilience. And additionally, all of the part of our organization that builds the countermeasures, it's called BARDA, or the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, works on having the countermeasures we need so that we can be resilient in the sense of where there are biological attack or release, we would be able to protect our population because we would have the countermeasures and the medications, and we would be able to get pills in mouth, shots in arms, whatever it takes, in a very short amount of time. And so we spend a lot of time and energy on all of those components.
That's a very interesting strategy for promoting resilience. What about strengthening the federal health, public health, and medical preparedness response and recovery capability within the country? And how does a whole community approach factor into your efforts in this area?
I think we recognize that no matter what we do, preparedness and response rests on a bedrock of a strong healthcare system and a strong public health system. That's why I am so concerned with all of the cuts to state and local public health around the country. Because you need a strong public health system to have a strong country. All disasters are local. And so local response and state response is always going to come first. And people rely first on their families and communities, and then on their state government, and then on the federal government to get this done in a series of interlocking pieces. So the first response is not necessarily the federal response, it's the local response. And we have to be sure that from a federal level, all of our programs and policies are aligned first to build that first line of defense, which is a strong local and state response. We also recognize that states and locals can't plan for or deal with everything, that some events are just too large or it's too inefficient. And that's really where the federal government comes in strengthening our federal response systems. That's where the National Disaster Medical System, for example, fits in. A preparedness system or preparedness and response and recovery are not only the purview of government. They are the purview of everybody. So individuals and families have responsibilities to be prepared and help each other out. Private sector entities, whether for-profit or not-for-profit, have responsibilities to lend their help and their resources in disaster situations, and they do. And it's really being sure that everybody can come together, that everybody has a part, they know what part they play, and that you can conduct that orchestra as it will, you know, in an event. That's the most important. But everybody has a role.
We've talked about a little bit about building resilient communities. We've talked about the importance of having a system that is strong and as well resilient. I'd like to talk a little bit about effective countermeasures. What are you doing in that area? And what does it mean to say we have a medical countermeasure enterprise?
So medical countermeasures are drugs, vaccines, devices that protect people from different kinds of health threats. The ones we think most about are vaccines, for example, that might protect you from a pandemic influenza or other kinds of pharmaceuticals that might prevent you in the case of a biological release or a new infectious disease. At some point, it doesn't matter if it's Mother Nature that causes this, as in a bad influenza pandemic, or if it's caused by bad guys. We have to deal with the end result, which is potentially an epidemic or a pandemic that would be fatal that could affect large parts of the population. So many of the kinds of things that we need to protect our people are not for diseases that commonly occur. And so the traditional pharmaceutical enterprise isn't so interested or hadn't been so interested in working on those things because there's not a big commercial market and because they're only used in the case of an emergency. So the Public Health Emergency Medical Countermeasure Enterprise, or FEMC as it's known, really brings together the different parts of government that are involved in the scientific development at the basic end, at the advanced end, the deployment of those measures to get to the point that we have countermeasures that are safe, effective, easy to use, easy to deploy, acceptable to the population, meet the needs of the population when you have them. And we are all in a partnership together. It involves many parts of HHS, DHS, the VA, DOD, the Department of Agriculture. We all are in a partnership together that now works very effectively to identify the countermeasures we need, to develop them, and when appropriate, stockpile them. We practice how to use them. And we're in partnerships and public-private partnerships all across the country with industry partners who really do a lot of the advanced development and make these countermeasures for us that we ultimately stockpile.
So how do you make a system that is so complex, nimble, and responsive to the many and diverse threats that you have to face?
I think we've had a really big shift in thinking, and I think we've really moved, shifting philosophically away from one bug, one drug, to the kinds of products that work on the underlying ways that people get sick. We call them host mechanisms of disease or whatever. I mean, you know, for example, that viruses attack cells in different ways. Rather than having a drug that would kill a virus, we would have a drug that would protect the cell or keep the virus from killing the cell, just in simple words. The other thing that we've learned from this whole countermeasure enterprise per se is that it has lots of spillover benefits for day-to-day use. So I'll give you an example. One of the things that we've worried about has been the nation's supply of ventilators. We worry both about the supply and we worry about getting them quickly to people who can use them and use them at a mass scale, which means they have to be smaller, they have to have a long battery life, they have to be easy to use, and they hopefully have to be more usable by people with fewer skills. So we've set out to develop the next generation of ventilators. In doing so, the whole field, the whole market has started to change and improve, number one. The price of ventilators has come down pretty dramatically, so people are seeing a day-to-day benefit. But we're also very close now to having pretty revolutionary technologies that will help us in a big public health and emergency, but also probably help us day-to-day in the back of an ambulance or for people who live on ventilators at home or other kinds of things. So it's actually very exciting to see this nexus between public health emergency use, you know, in a disaster, and day-to-day use, and understand that the investment that we make in preparedness has all of these day-to-day benefits.
And it's pushing innovation, too.
It very much is pushing innovation. And we are all about innovation in ESPR. We actually have an innovation team and an innovation fellow now working with us on the health resilience technologies.
How are we strengthening public health and federal medical preparedness, response, and recovery capabilities? We will ask Dr. Nicole Laurie, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Nicole Loring, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So, Dr. Loring, healthcare is a cornerstone of emergency response and national health security. What have you observed in terms of the preparedness and integration of healthcare delivery systems, and how has that guided your efforts to improve them?
Well, I think, again, in the beginning of the sort of rebirth of interest in preparedness post 9/11, there was a pretty substantial emphasis on getting hospitals ready and getting hospitals ready to accept mass casualties and deal with a huge surge of patients. Think post-Katrina, there was a re-emphasis on being sure that they got their generators out of the basement and could sustain electricity so that they would be resilient to the disaster and not have to evacuate. But most of the emphasis was on the hospital. I think that we've come to recognize that it's really the whole healthcare system that we're worried about, not just the hospital and not just one hospital at a time. Focus on the community and then thinking about what is it that we need the healthcare system to do day to day, every day, that we need them to do in disasters. We're doing that through series of drills and exercises that ask people to surge and create immediate bed availability as such to of up to 20%. And in doing that, they have to learn how they might clear out their emergency room quickly, how they might be able to quickly but safely discharge people who might not need to be in a hospital but could do well at home with some care or in a nursing home with some care, whatever. How they might need to use an ambulatory surgery center in an event, whatever. So we're building those healthcare coalitions. We're also placing a lot of emphasis on not just thinking you can do it, but showing me you can do it.
So you've made mention a couple of times of the, I mean, whether here or abroad, within the last decade, we've experienced or witnessed many national natural disasters, emergencies, earthquakes, tornadoes, the H1N1 in 2009, major oil spills, which folks, I mean, it has the public health effect to it. To that end, would you tell us about your efforts to take what you've learned from all those experiences that you folks were involved in and use those lessons to strengthen our current system?
Well, you know, that is actually a really big focus of what we do. After every disaster, there's what's called an after-action report. And so after everything we do, we sit back and we say, how can we strengthen our system and what's done? And there are a variety of ways in which we do that. And I can give you some examples. I think I talked before about, for example, H1N1. And we recognize that it took us too long to make and bottle and distribute vaccine. And so we've really invested in new technologies and ways to shorten the whole amount of time it takes to get vaccine and to get it out the door. That's a really concrete, tangible example. Moving to healthcare coalitions, again, became really important. And again, after H1N1, you know, I visited some hospitals where when I asked them how bad it was, they would tell me, well, we were down to our last ventilator. And we didn't know what we were going to do if somebody else came in. And I remember asking, so what was going on across town? And they were so busy focused on their sick patients that they didn't even think to look up and find out. And so that's the idea of healthcare coalitions really got ahead of steam after that, for example. In deep water, yes, it was primarily an environmental spill, but many, many people had health worries and concerns for their livelihood. And in some sense, on the health side, a large part of it was a mental health or a behavioral health event. People were very fearful. And from that and from some other things, we developed a behavioral health plan for how to deal with the behavioral health aspects of any disaster because they're part of any disaster. And we just never had one before. Recognizing it explicitly let us be able to do something about it. Internally, we've changed the structure for making leadership decisions mm-hmm. as time has gone on. It used to be in disasters we thought that all we needed to do was send out teams from the National Disaster Medical System to help out. Well, it turns out that the whole department needs to come together and make policy decisions almost every day. And so we now have a much more organized and formal structure for doing that. And I will also say that that also runs on top of a day-to-day system for quality improvement, okay, that good business practice, good management practice, being effective stewards of taxpayer dollars requires us day-to-day to think about how to do things better. And so we have a whole series of quality improvement initiatives that run across all of our organization. And they range from things like answering the mail faster to shortening our time for issuing contracts with countermeasure developers and all kinds of other things. So we've taken that really seriously day to day, and we've taken it seriously on game day.
It fosters a culture of continuous improvement, I gather, and sort of excellence.
It very much does. And at the end of the day, my goal is that it makes us more efficient, it makes us better at what we do, and it makes people who are unbelievably dedicated to the mission, working 150% all the time, less fried because they're not having to do as much repeat process stuff, for example. They're working smarter. They're working much more efficiently.
Well, I'm glad you went. It's a great segue because I want to talk a little bit more about your internal management efforts. And what I mean to say is that we've done a wonderful job explaining your mission and how you actually achieve it. One way, and I've noticed it with some of my other guests, is they talk about the use of data analytics and how they make better decisions. I'm wondering if in your efforts, do you leverage the power of data analytics to make better decisions and perhaps help you meet your mission better?
Oh, very much. You know, and I come at this, you know, from a entire career in research. So at my heart, I'm a data geek. And at my heart, I solve problems by asking and answering questions. Mm-hmm. So to that end, we're looking at data all the time. We look at data that underpins all of our processes, and we leverage, quote, big data, other federal data to do our job better. So a great example of doing that is in our operations center, where we run a program that we call MedMap, and it's a mapping platform visualization that lets us look at the country or any part of the country in which something happens. And we can pull data from anywhere so we can know, you know, first and foremost, who lives there, mm-hmm. what is their age distribution, what language they speak, what kind of resources they have to take care of themselves. But underlying that, where are the hospitals, where are the clinics, where are the roads, where are the runways, where are the pharmacies, whatever. And so we pull that together and analyze it in different ways during a disaster so that we know what happens. We just started getting data from the Department of Energy on power outages so that we can actually overlay data about current power outages with data about healthcare facilities, for example, and soon I hope data from people who are power dependent so that we can pull this all together and do a much better job taking care of people. So that's one way in which we manage our resources. Our quality improvement programs have us look at data every month, if not more often. And then we have a strategic plan, like most other organizations, that we're really serious about implementing. And so we use data and analytics to mark our progress on our strategic plan, understand where we might be hung up, examine why we're hung up, and think about how to get us on track. This has actually been really rewarding. One other way in which I use analytics, and I'm very serious about it, is in our employee surveys. Because at the end of the day, we're only as good as our employees, and I want to be sure that people get up every day happy and excited about coming to work, that we ask people to do a lot, and I really want to be sure that they're engaged and have an opportunity to represent their views in a variety of ways to me. So one way to do that is through the employee survey. And we actually very much track our scores. We do our own internal survey as well as the federal surveys. And we very much track our scores, implement actions to try to improve situations, and then look to see if they improve.
Well, that's an interesting. I mean, what are you doing to make sure you have the right, well-trained, highly effective workforce? And how does leadership and mentoring fit into that?
Great question. So at the end of the day, as I said, we're only as good as our people. And so part of it starts with making this a place that people really want to come to work. Aspirationally, I would like Asper to be the best place to work in government. We have a great mission, and lots of people very much resonate with that mission and want to come work with us. We celebrate our successes, and we work on improving the things that aren't so successful. I need to be sure that we have very active mentoring programs and that there are career paths that people can see for themselves, paths to development, paths to advance, paths to take on more leadership responsibility over time. So we have a whole series of mentoring programs and development programs. Within Asper, we take advantage to a very significant degree of a lot of the federal programs that are out there, whether it's the Excellence in Government program or whether it's the Federal Executive Institute. We also have a couple of fellowships where people come and rotate through. So we might have, for example, emergency physicians on a fellowship come and rotate through, or Army War College fellows that might come rotate through. Or I've had people from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Clinical Scholars Program come rotate through. And all of those bring new ideas into Asper. They build a workforce for us, and our own internal programs help people develop as well. I'm also, as a leader, I think, pretty open and accessible and try to be. So I'll have, you know, an open door hour at least once a month. We'll have a breakfast with a randomly selected group of people across the organization at least once a month. And a lot of times people will come in either just to introduce themselves or because they want career advice and they're looking for new opportunities. And it's great when I hear about it at the front end and I can find opportunities for them to develop in advance within the organization as opposed to deciding they have to leave in order to develop. And so we're very serious about, you know, retaining and developing and providing opportunities for our workforce. People can rotate across different offices, do other kinds of things that often give them the opportunity. And then people have been resonating a lot to our innovative programs, our innovation programs, our innovation space, and having a resource for innovation that people can tap into and use. Because if good ideas come from anywhere, good ideas come from and should come from everybody in the organization, and I need to create an environment where those good ideas can be recognized and really move forward. So we do that as well.
What does the future hold for national health security, preparedness, and response? We will ask Dr. Nicole Lorre, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, BA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Nicole Lorre, Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So as a follow-on in the last segment, you laid out your efforts to make sure you have the right people in the right spots who are technically capable. What I'd like to understand is, in this era of fiscal constraint, how do you keep your employees motivated and focused on the mission when there may be sort of when they're facing dramatic, maybe painful changes?
You know, it's a really great question. And I think one of the things that is so hard for federal employees in general is this sort of constant drumbeat of sort of bashing federal employees because they're federal employees. In fact, the people who are in our organization come because they are dedicated to the mission. And gosh, I don't know anybody that works a 40-hour work week there, to be honest. And people work really, really hard day in and day out because they know we don't have much time to get ready for what's going to happen next. So for them, a lot of the satisfaction comes from the mission. And, you know, when you respond to a disaster and save lives and help people and communities, it is very, very rewarding. When you get a countermeasure across the finish line and have it licensed, as we just did, it is very, very rewarding for our scientists and others. And so we recognize and celebrate the rewards. We find lots of ways internally to recognize people that are not monetary. Because at the end of the day, most people don't work in federal government for the money. They work in federal government because they're committed to federal service or because there's a mission that they want to do or because they find the work fulfilling. And so focusing on that fulfillment is really important. Now, at the same time, I've got to be really responsible about what I do with taxpayer money. And I take that mission to heart every single day. So the more we can be efficient through our quality improvement programs and others, the more I am able to support my staff to do what they need to do to grow and develop. But I'd also say at the end of the day, there are things probably across all levels of government, federal, state, local, that are just not so efficient. And the challenge is to look at this budget crisis a little bit as a disruptive technology. You know, I'm not going to get very far right now by wringing my hands and getting everybody depressed. What I have to look at, and that's where innovation has been so helpful, is what this challenges us. It forces us to have to do something differently. And we're all up to the challenge, and it is very satisfying when we find that way to do something different that is cost effective. That doesn't mean that we can work with no money. It doesn't mean that we can work with drastic budget cuts. But it does mean, and I believe there are a whole cadre of leaders like that in federal government who really embrace change and efficiency and responsible stewardship.
So throughout our conversation, it's obvious to me and from your comments and your insights that partnering and collaboration are essential for you folks to meet your mission. I don't know if you have any more to offer to that, but I'd like to focus in on your international and interagency partnerships and collaboration and how you use them.
I would love to do that. So I would say, at least throughout the time that I've been in federal government this time, I see the federal family partnering in new ways all the time. Certainly for us in ASPR, we can't do our work in HHS without the rest of HHS at the table. So whether it's Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, coming to the table with payment policies for healthcare institutions, whether it's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration coming to the table to help us with behavioral health planning and response, whether it's the Agency for Community Living helping us figure out how best to serve elderly and disabled populations, whether it's CDC, so central to what we do, or NIH, we all come together all the time. And just about everything we do in preparedness and response, and now in recovery, we do as a team. And so we're able to really leverage the assets of everybody and all of the agencies in the department. And when the chips are down, when something really happens, we're all at the table providing input to one another, making suggestions to one another, putting what we've got in terms of assets and people on the table to come together in a response. The same thing I would say with the rest of the federal family. And I think I started with some of this, whether it's FEMA or the Department of Transportation or DHS or DOD or any other part of government, the Department of Education, who we've worked so closely with, both around H1N1 and now around school shootings. We all come to the table to work together. And I think that that's been very effective. Internationally, preparedness is absolutely a global mission. And disasters happen around the world all the time. We learn from things that happen around the world and from expertise that others have, and they learn from us. We're very, as you know, active supporters and participants of WHO, the World Health Organization, and work on a lot through the World Health Assembly. We are very dedicated, as the entire department is, to facilitating and helping with the implementation of international health regulations, which are key to the early detection and reporting of diseases or public health events of significance, so that there's good and early visibility to them around the whole world. We work in partnership with a number of other countries. A partnership that is particularly important to us at ASPR is something called the Global Health Security Initiative. That's an initiative, again, that started after 9/11 and anthrax. And it was an initiative in which a number of developed countries came together and said, we're all going to work together and learn from one another, both so we can help each other and so we can help other countries in the world. And that's been a very effective partnership in much of what we do. And certainly through whether it was H1N1 or deep water or the Fukushima reactor disaster, Japan is part of this and others, we all were able to come together, have a lot of scientific collaboration, a lot of policy collaboration, and a lot of communication so we all know what each other are doing, what the communication challenges are, and we can do a better job communicating without confusion.
As you look to the future, what are some of the major opportunities and possible challenges your organization will face, and what do you think you might do to actually meet those challenges and seize those opportunities?
Well, so many of the major opportunities are in this area of innovation, whether it's in innovating for health resilience technologies or for medical countermeasures or for just the way we do business. Opportunities all over the place, innovation in the use of social media. Scientific breakthroughs help us all the time in the innovation space. And so that's been, I think, very exciting. We are very actively working on innovation in bringing together all the data sources we talked about, like in our MedMap platform, in whole community planning for all different kinds of populations. We're focusing very much now on modernizing the National Disaster Medical System and helping it to be faster, more nimble, potentially have sometimes a smaller size footprint when that's needed, so that it can be most useful in the situations that it's called into act. And it's called to act in a whole wide range of ways, and we just need to be able to have configurations that let us do that. We spent a lot of time modernizing the countermeasure enterprise. Now we're sort of really working on modernizing many aspects of the response enterprise. Another area that I think is very, very important for the future is that responsibilities for recovery were transferred into our office about a year ago. And I think it's great because we now respond differently, knowing we're on the hook for helping a community recover. And we respond with recovery in mind. And for communities, it means that, you know, they don't fall off a cliff when it comes to interacting with a part of the federal government, but there's a series of partners that see them through from beginning to end. And I think there's a huge amount of future potential to learn how to do that better and more effectively and really focus much more deliberately on what beside money it takes a community to recover. Looking forward to the future in the medical countermeasure enterprise, where more and more of what we're able to make and develop helps day to day as well as on game day. I talked to you about ventilators. Another area where we've been working is that we have to develop new classes of antibiotics for the bio threats that face us, and because